I'm Chili Billy, the personality pickle.
Hi, I'm Greg, and I'm a nerd.
You must be kidding, aren't you?
I have never seen anything like this. The worst part has been watching the actual watching of the movie. Some of these were pretty terrible. Well, here we are back again. Box office battles with Greg and Eric after some time away. And I really apologize. We did not intend to be off the air from September until January. Really did not. It
you know, when you work at Oracle for like 10 years, they then give you a 1 year sabbatical and you just like get to go do whatever you want. And maybe that's what we finished off 9 good months of a podcast. And so we just decided we'll just treat ourselves to 4-5 months off. But we're back. We've got 75% of our working eyeballs here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me explain what has happened. So back in October, it's a long story. I'll try to be as quick as possible. We owe you guys some explanation. I did post on the Facebook, you know, what had happened. So all those that are on our Facebook page, you know why we've been gone. But there's a lot more to it than that. It was my dog, Brody, who I've had for 8 years, got ill starting around February, and he started having problems with his legs where they were shaking all the time. And we took him into the vet all year long. It was just one thing after another. And the doctor, our vet, kept saying it was musculoskeletal. Then they finally diagnosed him with pancreatitis, and it wasn't resolving itself. His pancreatitis levels were really high, and I was getting frustrated. And finally, my vet was like, I really don't know why everything's in it. So I said, all right, you're done. Took him to another vet. Vet said he needs an ultrasound and an MRI, and we'll see what's going on. So we took him to Ohio State University. They have one of the top vet, and it cost a pretty penny, let me tell you. But I love my dog, and we took him there, and he was diagnosed with Cushing's disease, which is a tumor on your pituitary gland that causes pancreatitis, among other things.
Named after the late, great Star Wars actor Peter Cushing.
Yeah, that's it, I guess. So we had a treatment plan, and it looked like things were going to be okay. The night he had the MRI, while he was in with the doctor, my wife and I were killing time. We're in Target, and my left eye just went out. 3/4 of it I could not see. So imagine being in Target, and all of a sudden, you can barely see out of your left eye. You just, it's all just black except for a little sliver. I'm like, something's wrong. I have had a detached retina in my right eye. That one just went completely out. So, you know, I kind of knew what it was. I was prone to have it happen in my left eye. We get the dog. We take him back home. It's an hour and a half from Columbus to Dayton. We get home, and I try to find a eye surgeon in Dayton. No, there's none. So they say I either have to go to Cincinnati or back to Ohio State. So we drive all the way back to Ohio State University. You had to go through the emergency room. We get seen about 2 a.m. They go, yep, your retina's detached. You're going to have surgery right away. I'm not going to bore you with the unbelievable details, but let's just say the rest of it was a nightmare, including with my insurance company, who finally, when we got to the eye, they wanted to do the surgery at their I&E clinic, not in the hospital proper. But when they put in the referral, they didn't put it in as an emergency situation, even though I was going to lose my eye. They're an eye clinic, so they just put everything in as routine. So my insurance company said, cool, we have 72 hours to decide whether or not we're going to let you operate. I'm like,
we're going to let you have your eyeballs.
Exactly. So I'm sitting there with an IV in my arm on the phone with the insurance company. And I'm like, well, I'll talk to the doctor. They'll change it from routine to emergency. No, you can't do that. Or it's a duplication of care.
Oh, no.
We'll deny the claim outright. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me, you assholes? So let me just say, there's like 5 people got involved. The surgeon just got on the phone and said, look, he's getting the surgery regardless. We're operating on him today. And you can either approve it or we can take this up after. So it's all good. The surgery itself was just insane. I got put under into twilight sleep. Yeah. And they put a drapery over me. And then when I came to, they told me I was going to come to during the surgery. It was like a 60s movie. So my right eye was closed, so I couldn't see anything. But my left eye was just colors and design. Okay. I could see the needle. They were using a laser, and then they used a needle to inject a gas bubble in it to promote the healing. And I saw the needle go into my eye, and it was like green and purple. And I felt nothing. I felt nothing. But it was so funny because I woke up and I told the doctors, I'm like, the two surgeons that were operating, they're listening to Franz Ferdinand's Take Me Out. So, no, you know,
that's a good tune.
Yeah, that's why I wake up to that. And they were just playing music, going about their business.
Don't you know? Greg's eyeball in the bowl.
So that'll stay with me, that song, anyway. So, yeah, I said, hey, guys, I'm awake. And they were like, yeah, whatever. You're strapped to the bed. You're not going anywhere. So we're not worried about you. So they finished putting the gas bubble in, and from then on, I couldn't see for about a month out of the left eye. It started to, it had a gas bubble in, and as the gas bubble shrank, I started to get vision in like a circular from the outside in. So it was really weird. And so you could see, like I could see basically above the bubble and slowly over time. By the end of November, I could see, I had about maybe 75% vision.
And I think the day you got out of the hospital, the Eagles got fucking killed by somebody, and I just texted you, like, good thing your eyeballs aren't fucking working. You didn't have to watch this shit.
Yeah. I can't remember what it was, because that was the least of my worries at the time. And so, yeah, so we ended up dealing with that. And sad news is that my dog, it turned out that once we started treating him for Cushing's, it turned out that was... The problem was worse than we realized, and the tumor that had caused the Cushing's was about the half size of his brain, so we had to go back and have a CAT scan. We found that out, and to give him radiation treatment therapy was going to be over $10,000 and would only maybe give him a year and a half more of life, and it wasn't going to be quality. And so we had to make the very extremely difficult decision to say goodbye. It was really tough. So I'm dealing with no eye, and within a couple of weeks, I had to say goodbye to my dog. It's just been outrageous. So, yeah, that's why we weren't on the air.
I mean, I'll make fun of your eyeball all day, but now that we know it's better, obviously, yeah. I mean, I was joking about it that day.
Yeah.
Team never too soon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You should have heard my 9/11 jokes on 9/12.
So it is what it is.
But your dog, mind. You know, those are like family. I'm not much of a pet person, if I'm being honest. Seem like more trouble than they're worth. However, kind of like kids. However, I know that there are people like you and like a lot of people who, you know, they really become a part of your life. I bet if I had one, it was around me for 13, 14 years, you know, that kind of stuff's really sad. So we were definitely thinking of you and sorry you had to deal with that. Now, we do have some fairly good news, though, that came out of that, right?
Yes, yeah. So just briefly on Brody, I got him as a puppy, like when he was initially born. And so I raised him. We had a bond. He, you know, I had him for 8 years and he never left my side. So I don't want to get emotional, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. It was too much. He was always there. So it was like right after I told my wife, I said, it would hurt so much. I was like, I don't want another dog for a long time. I can't do it. It was such a hard thing. But then a week later, I just missed him so much. And I'm on my phone looking up where can I find it. I wanted another Yorkshire Terrier, which is what Brody was. And just by coincidence, or I didn't even realize it, but I didn't want to go through a puppy mill or, you know, one of the pet stores, and I didn't want to do a rescue. I wanted a purebred Yorkie because they're super smart. They don't shed. They're amazing dogs. They're my favorite. So it was like, I was a big fan of Benji growing up, who was like a Yorkshire Terrier, and so that's why I've always had that thing. So anyway, so I found a breeder about 20 minutes from me, and at really reasonable price. It's on this app called Good Dog. If anybody wants information, email me. I will get you in touch with her. She's amazing. She's in Beaver Creek, Ohio. She'll actually meet you at the airport if you buy a dog from her. And I went to her house and saw her operation. And it's a home breeding setup. And it's beautiful. Everything's done inside. The dogs have their own space. They have their own little house inside the house. It's crazy.
Yeah, she has, free to fuck wherever they want.
They have two females and a male. They had a litter of four, and I met all four dogs, and we had one that I fell in love with. As soon as he grabbed me, he started pulling on my laces on my hoodie, and then he wouldn't leave me alone. So we got him. We brought him home a week after that. His name is Connor, and he has worked his way into our hearts. He is already a fixture in this house. He's taken over, basically. So, yes, everything comes.
Is there any significance to the name Connor?
Yeah. All right, so one of the things we like to do is, because our dogs are Yorkies, they're from York, England, which is close to Scotland, we like to give them either York or Scottish names. Brody was a Scottish name that we had picked up on. Our other dog, which is my wife's dog, is a Yorkie, and its name is Duncan. And I always call him Duncan MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, which is from the Highlander TV show. So it only was fitting that we named the new one Connor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod from the Highlander movie series. So yes, there is a Connor and Duncan, two MacLeod brothers. They get along thick as thieves. I'll have to bring a video in and show it. They play all the time. It's great. So without derailing the show too much, that's what's been going on. We had family in over Christmas. And side note, if you hear me crinkling cough drops, and my wife and I were both diagnosed with COVID over.
You buffoon. Why?
It just keeps getting better. Yeah. So we had family.
Honestly, dude, I know that 6 years ago, right around 6 years ago this time, like it was killing a bunch of folks and whatever, shut everything down. We all remember that. But like, dude, 6 years later, it's embarrassing to get COVID. Yeah. Like, that's fucking embarrassing.
Thanks a lot.
Like toe shoes or
Crocs with socks.
Yeah, just like, dude, it be sucks. Better than that.
It sucks. And I've had COVID. I think this is maybe the third or fourth time. The thing with this one is we all started getting sick right before Christmas. It started with my son, who was here visiting with my grandbaby. I think she was patient zero. I think she gave virus to everybody because it just whipped through the house. Christmas Day, at least half the house was just unconscious, laying around. Just after everybody opened presents, everybody just went to sleep in a sick coma. My daughter was here. She slept on the couch.
Grandbaby like 1 month old or something?
No, she was born in April, so about nine.
And you're blaming it on her because she's not here to defend
herself.
Well, she
was snotting up all over the place and coughing.
That's just kids, dude.
So, anyway, we did take her out to get pictures, and maybe that's where, with Santa, so maybe that's where it happened. But slowly, at first I didn't get it, and then it was after everybody left after Christmas, and then the following Monday, my wife was feeling really bad, and we went up and had her checked, and she tested positive for COVID, and then she was really bad, and then I just took it up right after, and now just the cough, the chest won't go away. Like, I feel okay. It's just the cough will not go away, and that sucks. So it's like I've been 2 weeks.
You have to cover your cough. You have to cough into your arm.
I know.
You know that?
Yeah, so nobody get too close to your computer screens or to the speakers, because I might infect you through the...
Okay, so
that's a new way of getting COVID, yes.
A brief aside, and I'm not going to even come close to, like, coming close to identifying this person.
Okay.
But a former employer of mine who was very, very high up in the court system, I worked for the federal judiciary.
Okay.
Was giving us a talk one time about vampire coughs, you know, and coughing into your arm. And she goes, I know, it kind of looks retarded, but we were like, oh. It looks retarded. She was like, oh, man. This is the same person who we had a candidate come in, and I used to sit on a panel to interview, who was in a wheelchair. And she was like, you know, listen, we really, like, don't have time to mess around. We need someone who's just going to, like, hit the ground running and, like, go for it. And we all just silently look over like, guy's fucking legs don't work.
Funny. I saw a meme where this guy, these people were playing basketball, and one guy was in a wheelchair, and they were shirts and skins, and his own teammate looks at the camera and goes, traveling. That's his buddy is in a wheelchair. But yeah, it's crazy. COVID is not fun. It's funny though that you say that the R word there. I think anybody that's in Gen X should get at least a one strike on that, because we grew up with that as a common term.
Let me try to do better.
We try to do better, but sometimes it's one of those things that just is deep in your subconscious. It's just always saying that's something that's so gay. That's something that everybody said on nonstop when I was growing up. That's so gay, and that's retarded.
I use it now to just mean like bad. Is that not, you're not supposed to do that?
I don't think so. I'll let other people be the judge of that. Shit. Try that tonight and see if that works, if we don't get any.
Okay, but if I just want to follow your logic,
yeah,
just briefly down the line.
Yeah.
We have to give people that were born sometime in the 40s.
In the 40s, no.
One N-word.
No, not one N-word.
The N-word was just part of ingrained in their brain.
That was not a common thing that was said when I was growing up. But that's retarded. That was said a lot growing up. And I had my cousin that I loved to death had Down syndrome, and we said that around him. He didn't know. He didn't understand what it meant.
He understood it. You don't call retarded people retards.
Yeah, he was 30.
You call your friends retards when they're acting retarded.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. That's what we used to do. Yeah, we wouldn't call anybody that. It was just our friends that we would.
All right. Did you ever do one of these?
What do you mean? Like do the pretend? Yeah, do the pretend cerebral palsy? I will neither confirm nor deny that we did that. We did a lot of stuff.
Before that moment just now.
Yeah, whatever. You know what's funny is that with the Stranger Things finale, the season 5, it's been going around on social media. That they're like, all right, so after this show is wrapped up, did kids really in the 80s just wander around completely free with no supervision in the woods, riding their bikes? And we were like, yeah, how is that so hard to believe? I guess it is in this society is because so many people stay indoors. And when they do go out, they're under parent supervision for a lot of it.
I mean, the thing is that in the 80s,
yeah,
and any time before the advent of the internet age, you didn't know. You were kind of insulated to news that happened in your town, maybe the national news on a national level, you know, that the president is doing this, that,
right,
you know, the armed forces are doing this. You didn't know that some kid in Nampa, Idaho was abducted and, you know, dick got bit off or whatever. And now, but now every parent is like, oh shit, if I let my kids roam around, they're going to get. So I think that that's among many things. One of the problems with just having all of this information at your fingertips is A, there's so much of it that's just bullshit.
Yeah.
And if you want to seek out someone who believes some stupid motherfucking thing like you do, it's pretty easy to find now.
Right.
Whereas before, you'd have had to really try hard to find somebody who shared your dumb fuck view. But also, it's just so much information all the time that we didn't get before.
Yeah.
Statistics show we're in the safest, you know, era that's ever existed. Violent crime, any type of crime. We live in the safest times ever, and we still, because we're, you know, fed information.
Yeah.
Do you want to know what I was doing while I was gone?
I was going to ask, sorry that you had to volunteer. That was going to be the next thing. How was your Christmas?
No, let's spend more time talking about you.
Let's do it. I'm actually about to run out of breath, so you go ahead.
All right. So the holidays were fine. And I'm glad that they were. The kids, you know, are spoiled brats and they got too much stuff and whatever. And I'm not really a part of that. So I'm kind of, you know, don't have to think about it too much. But about, I don't know, maybe a month and a half, maybe 2 months ago.
Yeah.
I noticed as I was getting out of the shower and standing and admiring myself in the mirror, like I usually do, looking at my muscles, looking at my toned body.
Are you tucked?
I was kind of dancing, just the bottom kind of hips part.
Yeah, nice.
And I, it was just a bulge, kind of like in my lower abdomen, upper pubis region. I don't know. Oh,
yes, yes.
the pubasial region. That's not the
bulge I thought you were going for. I thought we were talking about tucked.
I have a bulge in my actual pubis region. And I was like, well, I've lost a lot of weight recently, just stress and whatever. Lost like 20 pounds.
Wow.
And I didn't really have 20 pounds. So I thought maybe this was like some leftover something from that, like a fat deposit. But, you know, I did that thing like people often do. And I go on the internet and I'm like, bulge near my dick. And it's like, do you mean penis? And I'm like, okay, penis by my dick. And it's like, no, the other. Anyway.
Did you click on images?
Yeah. I was like, black. Bulge near my black penis.
Nice.
All right. So it really just came down to like, it's one of three things. It's either a hernia. But everything I'm reading about a hernia says like it would hurt, and it just didn't hurt. And, or it could be like a fatty deposit, or it could be like some sort of tumor. And I'm like, well, if I had to choose, I'm going fatty deposit first, hernia second, cancer of the panesial region third. Yeah. And I kind of just didn't do anything about it because it wasn't bothering me. But it was weird. Like it was noticeable, like super noticeable. So I finally made an appointment. I had met my insurance deductible. So I was just like trying to get, you know, I'm going to the eye doctor. I'm going everywhere I can to get everything done. And yeah, I just kind of pulled my pants kind of down a little bit and they're like, oh, it's a hernia. I was like, oh, okay. Well, I went and saw a surgeon and I did the same thing. And she goes, oh, it's a hernia. She goes, actually, it might be two hernias.
Oh, geez.
I had a not as noticeable bulge on the left side, but she noticed it. It's her job to notice it. And so this is called a bilateral hernia. Bi, because the hernias enjoy having sex with men and women. And lateral, because of the laterus involved. So I didn't go to an accredited medical school. I went to school at Columbia. In Columbia.
All right. Yeah.
Anyway.
Voodoo.
So, yeah. I mean, so they scheduled the surgery. Again, I'm trying to get the surgery knocked out before the end of the year. So I pay $0 to get, you know, whatever they do in there. I go to the hospital. My dad takes me up there. They just say it's laparoscopic. They're going to put three holes in you, but it's going to be barely noticeable. They'll just do the thing. It may take a couple of days to start feeling better, but you'll be back to work the next day there. And I'm like, well, I sit on my ass and work on a computer. I could definitely be back to work the next day. Well, Greg, first of all, you said they put you in twilight sleep. They wheeled me into the operating room. They asked me to please get from my like gurney or whatever they call it and onto the operating table, which I did. And I looked over and noticed that one of the nurses had like full sleeve tattoos. And I was like looking at them. And I mean, the next thing I know, I wake up in the recovery area coming out of anesthesia. Yeah. I don't know how they do that so quickly. But I mean, I had not been on that table more than 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And they had me fucking out. Well, anyway, I woke up. I was in a lot of pain. Of course, they're giving you fentanyl and whatever. So it's not so bad, but it still hurts.
Right.
Get me back to my room. Tell me to change clothes. I'm in a lot of pain. I go home. I'm on the couch for about a week, really up until about 2 or 3 days before Christmas. This was the Tuesday before Christmas that I had this done. And so it was a nightmare, dude. I was in so much pain. And it's not the spots where they went in. But from what I understand, if they're going to do it laparoscopically, they basically pump your stomach. You remember when Rod Stewart got his stomach pumped because he swallowed a gallon of cum?
Yeah.
That was sad. but anyway, they pump your guts full of air so it like expands so that they can see what they're doing in there, and they have like can maneuver the little
right
whatever pinchers around. And I mean, I think that like stretched out every part of my stomach, my abdomen. And I mean, I was a mess.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And crying, trying to get off the couch to go to the bathroom. The painkillers, it's like Tylenol with codeine.
Oh, yeah.
I don't, that doesn't do much for me except constipate me. And, you know, then I can't shit for 3 days and I'm like, this sucks.
Doctors, man, are so paranoid to give out opioids anymore because
I know
because of the crisis. So they get everything's Tylenol 3 with codeine and you just get nothing. It's same thing with me. Was my I had headaches and all I had, that's all I had. So you just have to deal with it. And, you know, in retrospect, at least we're not getting hooked on opioids, but it's friggin' hurts.
I'd have risked it. It sucked, dude. I just wanted to be able to like sleep. I'm like alternating like a heating pad on my stomach and ice. Yep. And I mean, it just from day to day, not feeling any better than I did the day before. It honestly took about 4 or 5 days before I noticed any better.
That's crazy.
But I mean, they shoved my two hernias back into my whatever.
Well, there you
put
go.
A mesh, the mesh on my stomach.
I have one abdominal as well.
So
So I had the I have the mesh. So we're abdominal buddies. We're
mesh twins.
Eskimo brothers, yes.
Anyway, but, well, that was really mostly what's going on.
It's crazy because, I had to, after my eye surgery, I had to lay on my stomach with my head in a whole pillow for a couple nights because the eye I couldn't lay on my back or my sides. Then I had to lay exclusively on my right side for a month. And I tell you what, if you think that's not bad, then you do it and you can't move. Plus I have a back hernia. We're just, they are lying.
It is.
But anyway, this is the sacrifices that we do for our audience, is that Eric and I both go through surgery to make ourselves better people, to be able to come back stronger and do this show.
I'm not any better of a person than I was before.
Maybe worse. What? I tell you what, I've been through a lot the last 3 months. I'm glad it's over. I'm glad 2025 is over. Happy New Year to everyone.
Oh,
and
we
are officially back. And so when we left, we were doing a category of the best fake movie bands in existence in cinematic history. So we want to pick that up where we left off. All we did at that point was we had a play-in match to decide who the 8th seed was going to be.
You made us watch 9 movies.
We watched 3.
And choose one.
And Sing Street was the winner. And they will take on This Is Spinal Tap tonight. Other ones in the category are Almost Famous versus Eddie and the Cruisers, The Blues Brothers versus That Thing You Do, and The 5 Heartbeats versus The Commitments. We are going to resume now. We're going to do this category from the beginning. So that means that tonight we are indeed having, for episode 7 of season 2, This Is Spinal Tap versus Sing Street. Now, we discussed the Sing Street already kind of in detail.
Yeah.
When we had the play-in game. So we've watched this, but it's been now, I almost felt like I should watch it again. Because we watched this back in mid-September. Was when we had the play-in match. And that's when I actually watched Spinal Tap again, too. But I've watched Spinal Tap probably
over 100 times. Unanimous on this. I mean, it's not hard to be unanimous when there's only 2 of us.
Yes.
But there were, like, 3 choices. But I remember that we both really found this one endearing and just kind of, like a really good look at what it means to be in a band as a kid and like how that develops you as a person and just kind of all the things that go along with it. And we thought that that was really cute. I don't even remember what the other movies were that we watched.
We watched CB4 with Chris Rock.
Oh yeah, that's
and,
right.
And Rockstar with Mark Wahlberg, which going into the three, I probably had Rockstar as my favorite of the three, but I had watched Sing Street a few years back. I forgot how good it was. And then watching it with the other two, it was clearly just a diamond in the rough, something that I don't think a lot of people have seen. So if you missed that episode, you should go back and listen to it. We're going to briefly touch on it. But it is one of those films that, if you haven't seen, I would recommend it to anybody, especially if you like films where it deals with a lot of, you know, has a lot of music in it. It has just that youthful, if you like 80s stuff, because this is it takes place in the 80s.
So that's what Ireland. I was going to say is yeah. They all three had really good soundtracks. Yes. CB4 had a gangster rap thing.
Yep.
Rockstar has the kind of Judas Priest heavy metal type thing.
Yep.
But if you like new wave, you know, 80s new wave, the Depeche Mode, Duran Duran type stuff, Yaz, you know, that kind of stuff, that's what Sing Street is built around, is creating a band in the 80s. And it was cute, first of all.
Yeah. It starts off cute, but then it gets like really deep. I thought it, you know, we've got in this image here, we have the main character, the protagonist, Connor, who really doesn't know where he fits in life. He ends up because of finances, having to transfer to a tough school, and he's kind of been sheltered most of his life up to this point. And you see the innocence in his eyes. And what's so fascinating, it's one of those movies, and we talked about it a lot during that episode, of the character development, how the character evolves over the course of the film and goes from this bright-eyed, naive kid who ends up in this tough school and then decides he wants to form a band with basically guys he hasn't just met, to be honest, all so that he can win the affection of the girl in the girls' school across the street from his school, because he sees her once, he falls for, and isn't that what guys do? Is like they see a girl that they like and they immediately form a rock band to be able to win her over. It's great.
I mean, I'm not saying that being in a rock band or being in a band in my 20s was a good thing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a bad thing, Greg. And, but I think there's a lot to building a band and being in a band and learning how to be a band. You know, everybody played their first gig at some point, you know, and not knowing what you're supposed to do. You show up and there's bands that are experienced and they know what to do. And you're just kind of like hoping you don't make a fool of yourself and you're, you know, all of these things. But as you were talking about kind of that character development, it really checks a lot of the boxes that we know of film and of life, this place in the world thing, fish out of water. So not only is he, you know, kind of confused about what he's good at, what he's not good at, who he is, he's kind of instantly shoved into a, you know, an environment that's hostile to what he's used to. And yeah, the development over time is, it's just, do you remember when we did the sports movies and we were talking about Slapshot, and we talked about how that movie didn't have to be about hockey because the themes were so universal.
Right.
And that's kind of how I felt about Sing Street, was that yes, they created this movie using a band as a backdrop, but it almost didn't have to be about that. I'm glad it was, because that made the movie great and the music great, but the themes of it and just how I think really well they pulled it off. It just reminds me of Slapshot in that way, in just that it was just a vehicle for the characters. It was just a vehicle for the times. Obviously, I was pretty young in the mid-80s. Yeah. You weren't, so you would have more experience with that.
I was about the main character's age, so I identified with that lead character. Granted, I wasn't in Ireland, but yeah, you're right. The themes, there's so many to deal with, but it's like this family that is, they were kind of middle class. The father loses his job and has to deal with that lack of being the provider. You see in the still images here how they had to turn the heat off, so everybody's wearing a bunch of sweaters, and they're having to do more with less. The marriage between the father and the mother are falling apart, and the kids have to band together. The oldest son is a pothead who had a chance at maybe being a musician and doing something great. He loves music. So yeah, you've got all these things here that the band that comes into it is just the vehicle to allow the protagonist to be able to escape from these realities. He's not got a great home life. It's not abusive, but it's there's a lot of love there, especially from his brother. I love the relationship between him and his brother, who acted as a mentor to him and constantly encouraged him to do something to get out of that environment, and it ends up becoming the band, but only because he wants the girl. But the thing that's so great with movies like this is that's just the catalyst, and then once the band starts happening, he realizes that that is his place. Yeah. And to have the girl would be amazing, but the band is lifting him up into a whole nother place. It gives him confidence, starts to change his style. He starts to become more social instead of, he ends up fitting in with that band. He finds a family in the band. It's just when you, I said it before, I recommend it to anybody. This is one of those movies that you watch and have no idea what you're going to get into going into. When it's over, you just sit and watch the credits.
Yeah.
You don't turn it off right away because it still just sits with you. It's a great film.
Well, the brother fills that role of like Yoda in Dagobah when Luke is training to be a Jedi in Empire Strikes Back. But I mean that tongue in cheek, but at the same time, that's also a big part of movies, is having that figure that kind of pushes you to be something that you're not or that you don't think you can be. And you are right. There's more to being in a band than the music and the teamwork. I do a lot of stuff at work where I present things. In November, I was on a work trip and hosted a big marketing meeting for like 200 of my peers. Mm. Walked right up there. It's not a big deal. The thing was like 4 or 5 hours long. I wasn't up there the whole time. We had speakers and stuff. Had I not been in bands for so long, I wouldn't have the confidence to do stuff like that. But now it's second nature. The ability to walk into a room and be able to at least hold a consistent and normal conversation with strangers is a skill that I learned by spending 6 hours a night, 5 nights a week in bars for 10 years, meeting people who, you know, want to come up and talk to you on the breaks or making friends. And so there's a lot of tangential things that come and we see it in the movie. It's not about me, you know, it's about the movie. And we see that his ability to be confident in wearing makeup. Now, maybe it was common, at least in that genre, to do that.
Right.
But you probably didn't go to school and see a bunch of guys wearing makeup. It was more theatrical and, you know, for show. But growing into just the things you know you are. Well, I remember we said that at the time.
Yeah.
There's no better feeling in life than when you realize what you are. Like, what am I? And more importantly, maybe more importantly, what am I not? What are the things where I'm just trying to impress people, or I'm just trying to convince myself that I am this type of person when I'm really not? And if you can start to narrow in on what you are, and we watch it happen in real time in this movie, and for a lot of people, that takes years. Some people never do it. You get to watch it happen in a less than 2 hour movie. And so I think it's kind of a universal thing that anybody could watch. And I would recommend it just like you to anybody. And you would identify with that. Now, you may not have it all figured out, who you are, what you're not, but you will identify with the struggle, the path that it takes to do that. And it was really cool. And that's to say nothing about CB4 and Rockstar, because I thought those movies were really great in their own ways. There's just a universal appeal to Sing Street, a movie that I had never even heard of.
Yeah.
And I don't think it has an actor in it that anybody would really know.
The only one would be the father who played Littlefinger on Game of Thrones. Everybody would recognize Aidan Gillen, who plays Robert the dad. So that's,
I have not seen 1 minute of Game of Thrones.
Well, then you wouldn't know who he was.
Or Stranger Things, which you were talking about.
Yep, yep.
Well, so, fuck those shows.
You're missing out. It's FOMO, man. You got to move on.
I don't have it. That's one of the things I learned about myself is I don't give a shit what y'all are watching. I didn't watch Tiger King. It never even occurred to me, even when that was at the height of its internet zeitgeist. I was like, I'm not watching this shit. There's no fucking way I'm watching this shit. I don't care if I don't get the references. I don't care if it's what people are talking about. I don't care.
I loved it. Tiger King was a blast. It's just, it is what it is. I don't mind trash, though. Like, the wife and I will put on guilty pleasure type trash. I don't watch a lot of it. I don't watch Real Housewives, but we'll watch occasional, like, what's the one? Married at First Sight. And shit like that. We won't watch like every season, but if it's on, we'll watch it. I'll watch occasionally one of the fat shows, like somebody 1,000-pound Life or whatever, just if it's on. It's not something that we watch religiously, but we did. My wife's a huge Stranger Things fan, so we did go to the movies to see the finale, and we had a blast. It's a good 80s retro sci-fi horror show. You like it, you like it.
How many episodes of My 1,000-Pound Life could there possibly be? First of all,
you're still hung up on that. How many people weigh
1,000 fucking pounds? And yeah. Second of all, if you weigh 1,000 pounds, I can already tell you what your life is like. Laying in fucking bed, not doing anything.
I don't know if it's 1,000 pounds. There's 1,000-pound sisters. There's maybe 800 pounds. I don't know. But like I said, if it's on HBO Max or something like that, we might put it on. Married at First Sight.
I'm just saying, it's not like you're going to watch these 1,000-pound people like in today's episode, we're going to go play basketball. Like, no, you're not. You might eat a basketball.
There was one episode of 1,000-Pound Sisters where the one girl, that she's like 500 pounds, she tried to learn how to drive. So they put her on a riding lawnmower.
They put her in a Mini Cooper.
They put her on a riding lawnmower, and she nearly crashed. That's good TV, in my opinion. So I guess I would watch that. Yeah, I mean, seriously. It's like, if we miss some, it's not a big deal. But we do watch Stranger Things, Game of Thrones. But Aidan Gillen, to go back to it, yeah, he's about the only one, because it's an Irish production. It's strictly an Irish film. The writer-director kind of wrote it autobiographically about his own upbringings. He wasn't in a band, but it was about him getting into the arts and getting him in out of his hometown and how his brother was in their life. And he just used the backdrop of the band. So
it sounds like what I would do if I was writing an autobiographical film and just be like, yeah, I mean, I definitely didn't have a 13-inch dick, but in this movie, I definitely did. Like, you just get to do that. It's autobiographical, except the parts where I just want to make up. I had giant muscles.
Yep. Okay. You could say it's based loosely on truth. You don't have to say what's loose or what
part?
Yeah, what part? Yeah,
my trousers.
I was the All-American high school football quarterback. Nobody knows whether I was
such
or not.
Such a stud.
It's not, you're not saying it's exactly true. It's based on a true story.
Based on events that never happened.
Yeah, that's a lot of true stories are like that. So it's the thing is, to sum up, as far as Sing Street, we did cover in depth back in September when we did the episode. An amazing, as far as fake bands go, an amazing fake band. The music in the album, on the soundtrack, I mean, is outstanding. I'm actually trying to get the album on vinyl, but it's like $150 waiting for that to come down because it's very rare, the vinyl pressing from it. But I'd like to have it because the music's really, really good. The final scenes and the when they play their school dance is outstanding. It's one of those climactic moments where they're on the cusp of greatness. And it just has that thing where, you know, it's a crowd pleaser, and it also has the emotional weight in it to carry you all the way through to the end. And so you never get bored. By the end, you got a smile on your face. You know, it's a great ending. The brother gets to watch the older brother gets to watch the younger brother go off and fly and do his own thing and make his way in the world. And he's done that because of this band. So the band, it has such a great purpose in this film, and they fill that purpose great. We didn't even touch, because we did touch on it in September, the members of the band are characters in the film unto themselves as well, and each one is hilarious. They have their own identity. The keyboardist that plays like every single instrument is like the main songwriter. He's an outstanding character. He keeps the rabbits in the garden.
Yeah,
he has these quirks. So again, we could go into it for at least an hour. We did that back in September, but I will say this: if you haven't seen Sing Street, definitely give it a look. It is one of the best fake band movies you will ever encounter. That's all I'll say about that.
I agree. But now we're about to get into our number one seed.
It is the number one seed for a reason, really, too.
It's the one seed for two reasons, if I could be so bold.
Okay, be so bold.
It's not even bold. I mean, this is not... We'll get into what makes the movie great.
Yeah.
The thing is that it defined what this genre is and what it could be. There were movies that had come out before this that were about bands, but this cinema verite-like type... filmmaking, that it's almost like a documentary of a documentary, right, about this band, that Christopher Guest and Michael McKean and who's the other fucking guy?
Harry Shearer.
Yeah. That they're all in their own rights, brilliant comedians and brilliant creative minds. It's just, all these other movies that we're watching, I guarantee you, if you interviewed the directors or writers, all of them to a man or woman would say that they drew some inspiration from Spinal Tap as a source material, even though Sing Street's a pretty, I mean, it's got some funny parts, but it's a pretty straightforward, you know, kind of drama comedy, dramedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Spinal Tap isn't, but I just think there's enough source material there to draw on. So we'll get into it right now.
Yeah. Let's discuss, because it's one of those things. I can't remember of a mockumentary prior to Spinal Tap, and I could be wrong. There may have been maybe some, none mainstream, none in the out there that people could remember as being a smash comedy. But Christopher Guest, who came up with this and then has done several other mockumentaries, Waiting for Guffman is one that comes to mind. A Mighty Wind is a really good film. Best in Show is another one that he's done. He's done a lot of these, but it all started with this one. And it's a great idea of following kind of an aging British rock band that is kind of maybe pinnacled. They're not really old. It's just that they've been out there for a few years and their fan base is starting to dwindle and they're going on like a triumphant tour of America to try to reclaim their fan base.
Well, I think part of the reason that it works is that they seem to not recognize at first that they're on the decline, and that makes it even funnier because I think they think that they're still a big act in the beginning.
Yep.
And so that disconnect is just another layer of what makes the movie funny, or what makes those characters funny, is that everything that's happening around them is so incredibly foreign to them because they're used to being way up here. We saw that in Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping. And so that's such a good vehicle for you were on the top, now you're on the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
What is that like? Is this a redemption story, or is it a crash and burn story?
There's so many good moments of that kind of thing where the spoiled rock star is trying to have their way. One of my favorite moments is when Nigel Tufnel, Christopher Guest, is backstage and he's trying to make a sandwich, and why is the bread so little and the luncheon meat so big? And he's like, why don't you fold it? Then he starts folding the little bread, and the bread keeps breaking, and he's like, this doesn't work. And look, if I fold it, if I just keep folding it into itself, And it's one of those spoiled brat moments of that they're making fun of these bands who make it so big. And then and Popstar, again, like you said, that's what made me think of it. It just builds on that. You know, like you said in the beginning, this is Spinal Tap set the groundwork for anything that came after it regarding fake bands and mockumentaries. And we see that and we loved Popstar when we reviewed it. And this is probably what started it, you know, started everything.
So the Wikipedia article about Spinal Tap does talk about how the film is satirical in nature and talks about the last waltz and the song remains the same in like the excess of what rock stardom is.
Right.
But they point to All You Need Is Cash by the Rudels.
Yes.
Always kind of this fake Beatles band. And that came out in 1978. So obviously All You Need Is Cash is not genre defining like Spinal Tap is, but I think that there was some material to build off that there's no way of knowing whether any of these people ever saw that film. But if they had, I'm sure that you can see that and go, okay, now wait a second. They did this, but what if we took it and turned it into this? And I think I think we see it a lot in a lot of different ways. Like, you don't have to be the first one with the idea. You don't have to build the first mousetrap. You just have to build the better mousetrap.
Right.
And I think that's probably what Spinal Tap did in this case.
The thing, it's funny you bring that up. It made me reminded me of something. All You Need Is Cash stars Eric Idle of Monty Python fame. And all three of the main actors in this film, like we mentioned, Michael McKean, Christopher Guest, and Harry Shearer, were on Saturday Night Live at one point. I think they were on it together at the same time in the early 80s before this film came out. And Eric Idle was a very big staple on Saturday Night Live. So it wouldn't surprise me if they were friends, but that was more of a British film. It wasn't really a mainstream U.S. film, All You Need Is Cash, but I have seen that. I would say that that's a funny film. To me, this one kind of perfects it, where All You Need Is Cash, they stay so focused on the Beatles joke that it kind of becomes one note. Mm-hmm. This, like you said, with the Led Zeppelin references and stuff, really just, it has this really great developing plot. And when they started, it seemed like there was no plot, but it really does build through the constant touring and things going wrong, mishaps throughout the tour, till ultimately it leads into disaster and the bands end up infighting and they end up breaking up and having to get through their differences. It does have a plot, but it works so well.
And it kind of comes at you from both sides, which I obviously will love, in that the characters that they meet along the way, record executives who are so smoke up your ass.
Right.
You know, and just the way that they get treated by all of these different characters. And then on the other hand, you've just got all of these situations that keep happening to them that either at one time in their life would have been handled by somebody else because they had that level of success, or it just wouldn't have affected them because they were so kind of insulated from that. Like Taylor Swift doesn't know all of the workings that are going on around her, what it takes, you know, I mean, I'm sure she's plugged into the general specifics,
right?
But there's a level of granular detail that she's not ever going to know. And I'm sure that when you're in a big rock band like that, that's how you want it. You pay people to do this. It supports an economy and it allows you to do the thing you're good at, which is play music. Right. But as your star starts to fade and you can't have the people doing that for you anymore, like you said, with the sandwich thing, it's like things that are very normal and common to the rest of us. You know, like, listen, if you're Lenny Kravitz and you need a gallon of milk, you know, you like pour a bowl of cereal, you open the fridge and you're like, fuck, we don't got any milk. So you close the fridge and what? You go walk into your closet and you take off your pajama pants and you put on fucking snakeskin pants and a mesh tank top with two scarves and a hat. Like,
it's a normal outfit for Lenny Kravitz on weekend. Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, like, exactly. You have to be that all the time. I've never seen Lenny Kravitz just walk out of his brownstone in New York City in like gray sweatpants and some Nikes. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
And so I think you have built this idea of what you are, or you're just used to it being that way. And then all of a sudden now you're dealing with it. And that's normal life for the rest of us. But for people like that, it's so different.
Yeah.
Ask Celine Dion the last time she was at a grocery store.
Well, you know, and it's like those things where, again, when you have to, when you don't have the financial ability to keep a staff of assistants, we see it in Popstar, where he has all these yes men around him, and as things go worse, he ends up back in his mom's house, and there, you know, he ends up having to do things for himself. And it's similar with Spinal Tap, is that the manager ends up quitting. We get this thing that I thought was really cool, was that the film, like you mentioned, all the crazy people that are involved in the film, that the managers and the record execs, they, it seems like the band is very united at the beginning, where they're really close to one another. They really have a good vibe and a good time, and it's them. Whenever somebody acts stupid, they're usually banded together. But of course, just similar to like the Beatles, once we enter with, you know, David St. Hubbins, which is the Michael McKean character, his wife gets involved, similar to Yoko, starts to put a divide in the band, and you start to see that rift. And it's just, it's one of those things that's, you see that happening in real time, like it happened to so many other bands, where bands, you see they're fracturing, and it becomes this interpersonal relationship, and it really affects. And what's interesting is because they treat Nigel and David's history similar to John and Paul, where they grew up together. They loved writing songs with one another. So you get this this vibe of them being these really, really close friends. But after all this time, it's worn on their relationship. And then you throw in the Molotov cocktail of a jealous spouse who wants more control. It ultimately ends up to the band leading to break up. One of the things I wanted to mention before we go too deep into the movie, too, is that this is directed and starring who runs the documentary. And that's his name in the, is Marty DeBurgi in the film, but it's played by Rob Reiner. And he also directed the film. And here he is in this, this still image at the very beginning of the film where he introduced it. And this is,
I've not heard a lot from him recently.
Oh my Lord. Too soon. You're doing the too soon thing again. So, yeah, no, there's a reason.
Wait, this just in?
Yeah, this just in. There's a reason. Yeah. So if I'm sure anybody that's not been on a born under a rock or staying under a rock knows that that he passed away recently at the hands of his son, allegedly, looks that way. And it's unfortunate. Him and his wife both were killed. So, you know, the thing about Rob Reiner, this is one of his earlier films. But what I realized and what I forgot was how many movies he did in the 80s and 90s that were staples of American cinema, that what he gave to us. So, you know, it is a shame. And the wake of his death, so many people who knew him had nothing but great things to say about him. The people that knew him and the people that loved him, about how he helped them in the business and tried to do good things for people in Hollywood. So it's a sad thing.
I was reading about, apparently he and his wife were sending out some weird emails like right before that happened, but it just turns out that they got hacked.
Oh my God. Oh Lord have mercy. That's wrong. But we'll moving right along.
You know what we got in the wake of Rob Reiner's death was our esteemed president sending out, you know, a shitty fucking tweet like he always does.
Well, at least he didn't say we're hacked.
It's just like who are you? And don't you have better things to do than to be a delusional old fucking dickhead? Like, just try today to be a normal person. Like, just for one day, see if you can go from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed without saying or doing something fucking retarded.
Well, like they were hacked. But I will say this to that is that
that joke's fucking funny. If he were funny,
if he were, it'd be okay. Okay, I got you. But no, the thing of it is that no matter what your opinions are, is that you should never, if something, a tragedy like this, to sit there at the time that it happened and to point that out, that he was whatever you thought he was, you could show a little bit of grace and a little bit of class and just say, you know, I may have had our differences, but this was a kind man or whatever that you want to say. It people have the grace to be able to do that. And obviously they didn't happen, you know, and I may not have been the greatest fan of Rob Reiner personally. I didn't know him personally, but I grew up watching him as Meathead and All in the Family. He was great in that. And then his directing career, he gave us The Princess Bride, Stand By Me, so many others, When Harry Met Sally, if I'm not mistaken. So it's like he built our lives through cinema, and people loved him in that realm. So it's tragic. So I don't want to spend too much time on it, but yeah, it in this, when we planned this movie to put it in there, he had not passed away. And when I watched it, he hadn't. And I remarked, and I watched the new version, the sequel, the Spinal Tap 2, and he's in that.
Oh yeah, I remember.
And I went to see that in IMAX and enjoyed it. And then this all happened after we had planned on covering this. So this was not like an intentional thing. It's just kind of the way it turned out. But he does direct this film really well. Christopher Guest came up with the idea and the script and everything. It has amazing characters. We talked a little bit about the manager. Ian Faith is hilarious. And he like rules with a cricket bat. He likes to smash TVs with his cricket bat. He's got a and he goes back to that a 70s rock and roll manager. It definitely has that vibe of the 70s. Some things we don't even see today. You know, if you remember this. I'm talking about the type of managers. We don't see the manager to the forefront unless they're a crazy parent. You know, we usually that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that right now with the way the stars are, music stars are done today, their PR teams are so carefully manicuring their image that anything that goes on behind the scenes, they try to hide as much of it as they can. And then we get leaked a little tidbit of this and that. But compared to some of the stuff that came out in the 70s, I don't know that we've had stuff like this. I think
there was a time where the manager he was kind of like a carnival barker, right? In like a P.T. Barnum type thing, you know, the colonel with Elvis, your job is to kind of like bluster up as much whatever you can. And it's not like Elvis needed that, because he already was a phenomenon and just kind of a culturally significant person.
Yeah.
But you are right. I mean, we know the Colonel, you know, we know that Brian Epstein was the manager of the Beatles, like, and maybe that's just historical, because we can look back and it's pretty well documented, the effect, probably negative in the Colonel's sense, in the very much the positive in Epstein's sense, not that Epstein, Epstein. And when he died, I mean, people, the scholarly stuff that I've read about the Beatles points way less to Yoko than it does to the fact that Brian Epstein was able to manage three egos. Ringo wasn't a part of the push and the pull as much as John and Paul against each other, and then George kind of against those two, but that Brian Epstein had such a role in keeping that together. And when he died, it just, the wheels shot off of the thing.
Good point.
But we remember those. And yeah, I couldn't tell you one manager of anybody except for JoJo Siwa, because I think her mom was her manager. But right, because we see them on TV and we know where this show ends up, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
Because they also want to be famous. Mm. Yeah, I think that's the problem, is that Brian Epstein didn't want to be famous. Yeah. He just wanted to manage the Beatles.
Yeah. It's evolved over time. I think that you go back to the 70s, you know, in the 60s even, and getting into the 80s, you had people that were building a stable of singers, and then they would work with the record companies to get these people signed. Now, the record companies pretty much control everything.
Yeah.
And that's evolved from through the 80s and then into the 90s. And now it's just, if you're in their stable, they do everything. They do all the promotion. You can have a manager, and Jarrett would know this much more than we would, but you can have a manager, you can have somebody that's running everything for you, but the record company is so integral into all of this and making sure that you fit that mold, where in the 70s, these guys could, I mean, that's one of the things about Spinal Tap that's so funny, is the excess that they do. That's what makes it funny, is because Ian Faith, the manager, can't keep these guys under control. They just continue to do whatever they want to do. They continue to fight. He continues through the whole film trying to please them until the point where he snaps and he quits. Yeah. And then when David's wife takes over, she realizes how difficult this type of job is. She books them at the zoo.
And they are second billing to a puppet show. Yeah, to a
puppet show, exactly. So it's like, you get this, you realize that not anybody can do this, but the 70s were such an interesting time for rock bands, is that it goes back to when we were watching Rockstar, even.
Yeah.
When you have this constant movement, you know, the constant touring and the constant partying lifestyle, it catches up with you, and it catches up with Spinal Tap in a big way. But it almost feels like
that it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I mean, I know that they become lifted up and maybe especially in the 70s, the consequences to their actions were very minimal compared to probably what they would be today. But I think we see in Rockstar, and then we see in Spinal Tap, but in a more kind of sardonically irreverent way, we want rock stars to have those personalities, because we dream about what it would be like to be rich and famous. We don't dream about what it would be like to be the world's number one recording artist and just wake up in our house and brush our teeth and then go downstairs and pour a glass of orange juice. Well, you wouldn't do it in that order. But you know what I'm saying, is that once. Sorry,
that's an underrated joke. The toothpaste and the orange juice. That's underrated. I like that.
But that's what we want of these right. people. You know, like I want, when I think about, you know, Eric, if you had just buckled down and like really thrown yourself into the music part of being in a band, as opposed to just the dicking around part of being in a band. And I don't dream about, oh, if I would have just done that, then I could wake up and buy and go get in my Ford Taurus and drive to Albertsons and pick up groceries. Like I think about all the crazy stuff. I would have a swimming pool in my living room and I would, you know, jump off the third story of a hotel into the, like it's that stuff that we dream about. And I do wonder if that informs the way that rock stars in the 70s, like they know that's what we want from them.
Yeah.
We want them to walk out shoulders back and looking like they're 100 feet tall. You know, Robert Plant walks out with those jeans on and I'm sure if you're standing there watching a show, he just looks like a giant. He projects himself as a giant. He looks like it. And I think, you know, again, Spinal Tap does a good job of like satirizing that these people think they're giants and they think that they have the ability to still like have that behavior and act that way. But as your star falls, so does people's desire to put up with your bullshit. And we start to see that like collide in the film.
Exactly.
And it's so good. You know, you can get away with things when you're Bono that you can't get away with when you're John Q. Yeah. Dickhead, you know.
It's a recipe for what is really funny. And what you just said reminded me of something that I hadn't touched on is that last year, we went to see Ace Frehley in concert a year before he passed. So it was last summer. And he came out and it was just in a little rock club, maybe 500 people. And we were fortunate enough, and I say fortunate because I'm a Kiss nerd. I like Kiss. So we got a table right on the side of the stage. It was basically on the stage. It was fantastic. So we were right side of the stage. But he came out with this massive entourage to sing in front of 500 people. And he still carried himself like a rock star. He's Ace fucking Frehley, for crying out loud. Yeah. And nobody cared that it was a small event. In fact, it was kind of cool that it was. But he was so messed up. And he was stumbling and
like drunk or?
Oh, yeah, drunk, high, whatever he was on. Now, that being said, played like Ace. He hit every note that I could hear, unless they had a backing track, and I don't think they did. He played extremely well. He sang fine. It's just that when he talked in between, he rambled and he stumbled around. But I'll never forget it. I was standing on the railing just, you know, hooping and hollering, clapping. And he noticed me, pointed right at me. I was just taking photos. Got a photo of him pointing right at me and then gave me his towel that he was sweating. He had like 50 of them throughout the whole concert. He'd wipe his head and throw it into the audience. So ended up getting one. It was like getting Elvis, one of Elvis's scarves. So when he passed, it was kind of like, yeah, I could see that because I'm not surprised he fell and hit his head. Unfortunately, that's the lifestyle. And so when you talk about the consequences in the 70s, like legally, maybe not so much. The consequences for a lot of these guys was death. I mean, that was a lot of these guys. If they
added a lot of members to the 27 club.
Yes. If they didn't die in a plane crash, they died of an overdose or car crash or something crazy. So,
yeah.
But Spinal Tap we could talk about Spinal Tap, I think, for a good hour because there's so many moments. But this isn't a show where we sit there and just recap our favorites. But I will say this. We want to at least talk about your favorite moment from Spinal Tap, and I'll talk about my favorite moment, and then we'll kind of wind this down.
All right. So I'm going to do two, like an understated one that I always like, and then kind of one of the maybe bigger bits. You know, there's the This Goes to 11 that we all know. Yes. That's a major bit in this thing. So my major bit is when he like has a guitar and a violin and he's doing like this kind of freeform jazz exploration. And then he takes the violin and uses it like it's the bow, but across a guitar. And every time it cracks me up. And along with that one, he's playing that classical piano piece in that same little part. And he goes, "That's beautiful. What do you call that?" And he just turns and looks at the camera and he says, "Lick my love pump." And my understated one is one of the most minor characters. It's Ed Begley Jr. He's the hotel front desk clerk. And I think it's the manager or one of the guys is getting really upset with him and calls him, I think, fruity or a fruitcake. And he just very deadpan says, "I am as God made me." And it's just, the delivery is so good. He says it without confrontation, just, you know, I am as God made me, and moves on. It's just such a little quick hitter. So those are my, oh yeah, there he is.
That's the scene. Yeah. Those are good ones. And, you know, we talk about This Goes to 11. Everybody knows that probably is my favorite moment, but it's one of those that is everybody's favorite moment. Cause it is that whole scene, not just that these go to 11. It's like when he's showing his guitars off to Rob Reiner and he's like, and this one, we don't even look at, don't look at it. Don't even look at it. Look away.
It's priceless.
It's priceless.
You can't play it. You can't even look at it.
And then he's like, "Listen to the stain on this one." It's like all that stuff. The whole scene is pinnacle peak comedy. But I think there's so many. Of course, Stonehenge is just bloody brilliant.
It's like, well, I'm not the one who brought out a Stonehenge that was in danger of being trampled on by a bunch of dwarves.
The fact that he wrote it on a napkin and he wrote it in inches.
It's not his job to know that. It's your job to know that.
And he wrote it in inches instead of feet is one of the best. But I think there's two that I really like as well. So I'll say two. I really like when they're on the Air Force base, because having been in the Air Force and being in that time where we had acts come in and perform in the hangars, and we would get, like, they would go to perform and the jet would go overhead and it would get really loud and they would have to stop. There's a famous one of Robin Williams, like right in the middle, the retreat goes off and everybody gets up and stands. That happened at performances where if it's retreat, you got to shut up. Everything there's things that happen. So that one always is just kind of near and dear to me, where Fred Willard hilariously plays the Air Force officer who is like making fun of their look. Then they get on stage and then the radio tower ends up interfering with the frequencies. It's just priceless. And then I like the probably my favorite. It was like one of the first scenes I'd ever seen, because I didn't see the movie. I saw it on cable and I think it was just turning it on, and the scene came on. And it's where they're doing the cocoons during the song, and the cocoons open up, and it's just a great moment where Harry Shearer's character, he can't get out, the bass player, Derek Smalls, he can't get out of the cocoon the whole song, and it's just one thing after another. They bring out a blowtorch, the guy's got a crowbar, he's trying to pry it open, and then at the very end, it comes open, and then the other two guys go back in, and then it closes on him as he's trying to go back into it. It's just, every time I see that, I could watch that whole scene over and over. It's just, there's so many moments of Spinal Tap that are just, they stick in your head. I've watched it a bunch of times. And so, and the reason it's got so much rewatchability is because of those moments. It's because of These Go to 11.
Well, why don't you just make 10 a little louder? Because it also reinforces just how clueless he is.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's just like, this is badass that it goes to 11. There's no reason for it to go to 11. And there's no reason I should pay, you know, money to have it custom made to go to 11. It's just badass that it does.
Yeah.
But we haven't even talked about the fact that for a movie that's meant to be silly,
right,
but like smart satire, but it's also a lot of it was not scripted. A lot of it was improv'd, where Christopher Guest would give them. Well, this is how the scene starts, and this is how we need it to end up.
Right.
So all of that combined, obviously, is what we're seeing, and that's what kind of Rob Reiner was responsible for. The music in this thing is so good. And so you were talking about how they set up in the beginning that they're all friends. Well, they go through all of the different iterations. They were the Originals.
Yeah.
Then they found out that there was another band called the Originals. So then they were the New Originals. But then the Originals changed their name to the Tradesmen or something. So they went back to their, then they were the Timsmen. And they had that song, Gimme Some Money.
Oh, yeah.
Which I play on my guitar every now and then because it's a straight ahead like 60s rock blues number.
Yep.
Like I Saw Her Standing There by the Beatles or something.
Yep.
And that song is good. Like if I heard that on the oldie station, of course my oldie station now plays fucking Smashing Pumpkins and stuff like that. But when I was growing up, K-Love, the oldie station, was 50s and 60s music.
Right.
And I'd have loved that song, you know, back then between Blueberry Hill and, you know, some, you know, Chubby Checker number or whatever. And then they move into their Flower People, psychedelic thing.
That's a good song too, though.
So what the flower people say. But then when they're like Spinal Tap proper, as we see them today, like, Big Bottoms,
that's a great song.
Is awesome. I was trying to look through some of these other tunes because they're just
heavy duty rock and roll. Good. Heavy Duty Rock and Roll is great. Tonight I'm Gonna Rock Ya is a great song. Yeah, Big Bottom, of course, stands out. Everybody that's heard that. And what's great is that these songs are comical, but they're not completely slapstick. So
no.
They have comedic undertones, but you could mistake any rock band of that era for making some of these songs. It's very Tonight I'm Gonna Rock You Tonight. It's just you got to really listen to find the jokes in there, and that's kind of one of the genius because they were all real musicians. They all wrote these songs themselves. This wasn't just something like they were thrown together in a lab. This was something that was they created on their own.
Well, we know that I know at the very least Michael McKean and Christopher Guest are like talented musicians.
Yeah.
Just they could come sit down and pick up an instrument and play it. I don't know about Harry Shearer or not, but they have A Mighty Wind, which is also kind of built around music.
Yeah.
These guys are more than just kind of chumps who made a movie about music. I think they've got real credentials and bona fides. Like Steve Martin, you know, we know he's a good actor, but he's got a really hot bluegrass band, the Steep Canyon Rangers.
Yep.
And he's a really talented guy. So I would watch a movie that Steve Martin made about bluegrass music before I would one that was made by Leonardo DiCaprio
or
something. You know, it just gives some credibility to it. So, I mean, I could see them taking that part of it seriously because you said it really well. Like there's layers to how funny those songs are, but if you weren't paying attention, it would almost be like those are real songs.
Right.
You know, and that is a hard threshold to meet where the music is badass and could pass for an actual rock and roll song while having all of these understated, funny moments. Like that's brilliant. That's brilliant songwriting.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's a phenomenal film. It's one of those things that if you love it, you know why you love it and you watch it repeatedly. I watched it. I don't know how many times I've watched it. I can put it on anytime and just enjoy it. Even if I only watch a few minutes of it, it's fine.
And this is a probably top 10 most seen movie for me. I had it on DVD. I would watch it with the commentary on.
Oh, the commentary was hilarious. It's one of the best parts with them narrating. So you watch it. Yeah, I did the same thing. You watch it with just the regular with it off, and then with it on is a whole different experience.
Yep. I mean, remember the very first scene, you know, the Spinal Tap logo comes in and then it gets really small and he's like, oh, wait, back it up, back it up. And it comes back on. I mean, I mean, I've just watched it so many times that I remember some of the stuff from the commentary. We have been kind of talking, we talked about Sing Street in a way like that we are assuming people haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. We're kind of talking about Spinal Tap, assuming that you have. Yeah. I think if you haven't, and if you heard Greg go over some of the other movies that are in this category, the Blues Brothers, the Heartbreak Kid, or no, that was Shawn Michael.
The Five Heartbeats.
Yeah. You know, if you like some of those other movies and you haven't seen Spinal Tap for whatever reason, and I'm not judgmental about that stuff. There's a lot of classic movies I haven't seen, so I'm not talking shit if you haven't seen it.
Right.
But if you like those types of movies, the Blues Brothers and the, you know, the movies that came after this that are similar, you've go back and watch this. We're talking about it like you already have, but it's a really foundational piece of media. And it's not just that it's a cult classic or all of the things that we've talked about.
Yep.
I mean, this movie's in the fucking Library of Congress as a culturally significant work of art, of cinema. Like, and for those who are like fairly new to the show, or if this is your first time ever listening to an episode, I don't know shit about movies. It's probably obvious by now. If you've listened to an hour and a half of this, you know I don't know anything about movies. But Greg kind of grew up really immersed in movies, and despite having a career in a totally unrelated field, you went and got a degree in an advanced degree in cinema stuff because you're that into it.
Yeah.
And so this movie kind of has a foot in both of our worlds. Dumb fuck me, who just needs to be entertained and needs to laugh, and you who finds a lot more intrinsic value in the artistry or what it takes to make these movies, or characters that fit into archetypes, or whatever the kind of academic view of cinema is. Well, obviously this one meets that threshold because, you know, it's in the Library of Congress. It's a culturally significant piece of art. I mean, how cool is that?
Oh yeah. It's not many movies end up on that level. There are several that do, but not many. And this is one of those.
Comedies especially.
Yeah, exactly. Comedies very rarely. So, yeah, it's an outstanding film. One of the things that I wanted to mention, the late, recently deceased Ozzy Osbourne said this about Spinal Tap. I was the only person laughing in the audience that wasn't laughing because it really was like a documentary to me. Those things actually happen. Everybody would go, oh, ha, 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 number 11. That happened. When they got lost going to the stage, that happened. And so, and knowing Ozzy, I believe him that happened. But it's when you have Ozzy that kind of endorses it, knowing that this is almost as true as you can get on a parody level. It's very sincere type of parody. It's not mocking the stars so much as it is kind of reflecting what they see in a funny way from these stars. I did see the sequel. I mentioned that earlier, the Spinal Tap, The End Continues. And I will say this, it doesn't reach the heights of the original Spinal Tap by a mile. However, it does, if you want to put it on a Saturday afternoon, you get it on streaming. The theater I saw it in, everybody was laughing out loud and having a great time, but everybody was Spinal Tap fans.
Yeah.
But so this was basically, you know, after all 30 years has passed or whatever, and they realize they owe the record company one last tour or whatever. So they come calling to collect, or they're going to owe a lot of money. So they end up getting the band back together, even though they're all fighting still, and go out on the road. And it deals a lot with being it. This one parodies the fact that you've got these bands out there at 80. You got Paul McCartney, Elton John, Rolling Stones out there at 80 and the struggles that they have. And Paul McCartney does a cameo. Elton John does a cameo, and they're both really funny. And it relates to that trying to stay fit and being on tour when you're that old. And so it is got some value to it. I did really enjoy it. It's just you're never going to reach the heights. You can't hold it to that movie. You can't hold it to that.
I mean, really, Godfather 2 is the only one that ever did that, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Empire Strikes Back. And I think most Star Wars fans do.
Yeah.
But those are exceptions to the rule. And yeah, it is nice to know that they had the wisdom to not try to go back to the same well, but to think about what it really would be like. I mean, and I expect that from people as talented as Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, Harry Shearer.
Right.
Because they've been doing this a long time. I mean, this movie came out in 84, and this probably wasn't their first go round. Christopher Guest was on Saturday Night Live in 81.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So by 2026, they've been doing this for 40 years. And so you expect them to have that thoughtfulness. Right. And we talk about that a lot on the show. It isn't always a matter of what the end product was. Greg and I often are like, we can just tell you were thoughtful about it as opposed to just trying to throw some shit together. Whether it's achieved or not, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But I'm glad to hear. And yeah, I wouldn't imagine it could reach the same heights.
Yeah.
But nice that they keep that in mind. Speaking of parodies.
Oh, no. No, you're not going to get me this time. I know where you're going with this. You're trying to do parodies, CDs, all of these. You keep the D's over there on your side of the screen. I don't want these nuts.
All right.
So that brings us to the moment of truth that we do every episode. We've gone over both films. This is Box Office Battles. So there can be only one winner that will advance to the next round. So we have to vote. Now, do you want to go first or I can go first? It doesn't matter.
That sounded like Highlander again. There can only be one. Only
be one, yeah.
Does he say that, or is it just like said in the movie?
It's said, I think, gosh, you know what? I'm going to have to watch that.
He does.
It's said repeatedly, yeah, there can be only one.
Yeah, we ran into this when Singing in the Rain went up against Godfather.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's nothing wrong with Singing in the Rain.
Nope.
We really enjoyed that movie, and it kind of came out of nowhere, like my Uncle Lonnie when I was little. The only problem with Sing Street is that it is going up against a genre-defining, culturally significant, thoughtful piece of art that not only can stand alone if you never saw any of these other movies,
yeah,
of the same type, of the same genre, but also will inform every movie that you see in this. That's its only problem. The only problem with Sing Street is going up against a really like tip of Mount Everest type Goliath of a movie. The votes for Spinal Tap, and it's not even close.
Yeah. So the thing is yeah, I'm going to agree. I'm going to say Spinal Tap, not even going to withhold it. It's Spinal Tap's definitely the winner. It is what it is. It's a fantastic film, and it deserves to be the one that we move on. It's the number one seed. I think had we done this right after we did Sing Street, I might have, it'd been harder for me because it was so recent in my brain and I really, really loved it. But this time, having this time off and then thinking about it has made a big difference for me. Is like, what am I thinking? Sing Street. Sing Street is a great film, but, and I still say, wholly recommend it to anybody that wants to watch a good movie this weekend. Watch
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. You will love it. But Spinal Tap is the one and only. It is what defines this whole category is built for fake bands. And we're going to see if any of these other fake bands can dethrone Spinal Tap in the upcoming weeks. We'll just have to wait and see.
I've got a sense that I know what our final two are going to be.
Oh, yeah?
And that it might be tough. I'll let you know when we get to that episode. All right. I'll let you know if I was right.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Well, the next one is going to be in a couple weeks. We're going to deal with Almost Famous, Kate Hudson, Patrick Fugit. Who else is in this? Philip Seymour Hoffman. Great film. I absolutely, one of my favorite fake bands is Stillwater.
Sweetwater, Stillwater.
Stillwater, yeah. Yep. Jason Lee in this. Mm-hmm. It's just phenomenal. It really captures the essence, again, of 70s rock star hysteria. I think this is going to be a great battle. It's going up against an 80s film set in the 60s, I believe, early 60s. Eddie and the Cruisers. Which is a great, I think you're going to like it. I know you've not seen this one.
I've not.
It is also, it was in the 80s, it was one of those films that most everybody saw. The song, there's a song on the Dark Side that is very popular. You've heard it on the radio. You'll know when it comes on. John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band sing it. But that's Eddie and the Cruisers. So I think you will enjoy that. Is in a couple of weeks. I did want to, before we head out, I just want to say hi to Mike Florida, Mike Lebonovitz, who is always here for every episode. Just want to say thanks. He welcomed us back right off the bat when we showed up and said welcome back before we even went on air. So thank you very much, Mike. We're going to have Mike on sometime this season. I need to reach out to him and decide what category he wants to be a part of.
Yeah.
And just have him as a guest. But that's it for this episode. We've got our winner. This is Spinal Tap, Almost Famous versus Eddie and the Cruisers coming up in a couple of weeks. So, with that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Eric.
Hey, aren't you supposed to give some contact information, email us, or...
Oh, do we really want people
to do that?
No, I didn't do that. I should do that. If you like what you hear, make sure you follow us on all your podcast providers, whether it's Spotify, Amazon Music, or Apple Podcasts. We're doing really well right now. We could always do better. So, tell your friends and tell them to subscribe and listen to us on those platforms. If you want to email us with any suggestions or comments, you can do so at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. And as always, you can catch our live streams on YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast and on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod. And of course, we're on Facebook as well. So don't forget to check those out. So thank you, Eric, for reminding me to do the contact info, because I'm usually really bad about that. I keep bringing it up during the live stream, but we always want to tell people to.
I mean, I get that nobody contacts us, but I just feel like the more we put it out there and manifest it into the world, then one of these days, somebody's going to email us and be like, why don't you two shut the fuck up? You don't know what you're talking about.
I would enjoy that.
That would be fine. Yeah, that'd be great.
You know, it's funny, while we were off the air, I don't know what was going on, but I was following what our streams were and our past streams for a week there. I don't know what happened. We were doing about 80 list streams a day. So I don't know what's going on, but...
Vietnamese click farm.
Could be. And I'm good with it.
Thank you, Vietnam.
Thanks so much. That being said, Eric, you can go ahead and say your final words.
All right. We appreciate you guys' patience in letting us have a little time to collect ourselves and get back to our best version of us. Thank you very much for that. And until next time, remember, be excellent to each other. We'll see you then.
See you in a couple of weeks, guys. Have a great night.